Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. From the first days of George W. Bush's presidency, the White House has disrespected Secretary of State Colin Powell. In almost every aspect of American foreign policy, Powell has marched down the middle road, while the Bush administration has veered off to the right. In an era of renewed American unilateralism, the multilateral and moderate Powell often winds up justifying administration actions he does not support to the rest of the world. Washington is agog with speculation about a Powell resignation, but the Secretary of State is also a four-star general. Those close to him insist he'll soldier on. But can he? Listeners, are you alarmed about Powell's eclipse? Should he resign or suffer his humiliations in loyal silence? And are his loyalties toward the Bush family in conflict with his loyalty toward the nation? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Virginia is Jim Loeb. He's Washington Bureau Chief for Interpress Services. He's also author of the article, The Unimportance of Being Colin Powell, which recently appeared in alternet.org. Welcome, Jim Loeb.
Hello.
You write in your article, Colin Powell has been reduced to little more than a fig leaf used to cover the excesses of the most radically unilateralist administration since World War II. And then you go on to print, to reprise some of the humiliations he suffered, reversals just in the last month. Can you go through some of those just in the last month?
God, I hope so. I'm on vacation now, so.
Well, I'll refresh
sure,
you.
I think we've got a few. There was certainly the whole question of peacekeeping, and the use of peacekeeping as in order to attack the International Criminal Court, and the willingness of the United States essentially to veto peacekeeping operations if it couldn't get its people exempted from the jurisdiction of the ICC. I would say the UNFPA was another.
That's the United Nations Populations Front. He had actually sent. Well, you tell us the story.
Well, the Congress appropriated up to $34 million as part of a compromise that was brokered personally by Powell last December in order for the whole foreign aid bill to get through. It was there was a clash between House Republicans, who are quite anti-abortion, and Senate Democrats and Republicans who favor family planning, and particularly the UN Population Fund. Powell himself has spoken several times in admiration for the work of the UNFPA, and he brokered this agreement whereby the administration agreed to provide up to $34 million to the fund.
Which operates in China.
About three. I think the program is about $3.5 million, which is quite small.
Mm-hmm.
I think their total budget is $270 million worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And under pressure from the right, or we don't even know if it was under pressure, the anti-abortion groups led by Chris Smith in the House, a New Jersey Republican, asked Bush not to spend anything, not to spend any of the $34 million that had been appropriated by Congress, which was technically a kind of violation of what Powell had himself personally worked out. Bush said that he would consider suspending it, but he wanted to check it out himself. And so he asked Powell to send a special State Department delegation to China to investigate whether or not UNFPA was providing some assistance to agencies which practiced coercive abortion or sterilization,
mm-hmm.
which was the basic issue.
Mm-hmm.
So his State Department delegation went in May. that was a three-person delegation, and came back and basically said that UNFPA is certainly not knowingly providing any assistance to such agencies. It did say also that there were regulations that were inherently coercive in about half the counties where UNFPA operates.
Mm-hmm.
But it recommended that they go ahead and spend up to $34 million.
This is Powell's own State Department validating the policy.
Yes. There was a suggestion that you could maybe withhold the money, as the United States has done mm-hmm. in previous years,
right.
to compensate for the money that's spent on China by UNFPA.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
this would be a very small sum.
Right. Right.
In any case, Bush told Powell, or, I mean, we don't know the inside, but ultimately the administration decided they wouldn't provide any of the money. They would zero it out despite the findings of the State Department delegation.
And despite the fact that the Secretary of State had worked this out with Congress.
Yes. And so it was, I mean, it's not necessarily the most important issue
no.
on the U.S. foreign policy plate, but it was significant in view of Powell's own personal role.
Right. And you also mentioned that the State Department had argued in favor of attaching human rights provisos to aid to the abusive Indonesian armed forces, but they were overruled, this just in the past month, by the Pentagon. That the State Department had counseled a U.S. abstention on a new U.N. treaty to prevent torture. And the administration tried to derail it and then voted against it, along with China, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Iran, and Cuba. Again, this is just in the last month. And, of course, over the last year, just off the top of our heads, I can think of a few things. The whole possibility of war with Iraq, for example. Colin Powell and the State Department were certainly trying to hold that back, were they not?
Yeah, and I think they still are.
They still are, yeah.
And I think the most spectacular example is the Middle East, because this is the first time, by that I mean the Israel-Palestinian
sure.
conflict, this is the first time that the United States has aligned itself with the right in Israel, with the right-wing parties of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
That's never happened before, and it goes very much against the State Department's, and for that matter, the CIA's druthers. And I think what's very significant is that Brent Scowcroft, which I think I mentioned in the article, who was National Security Advisor to Bush Sr., published in the Washington Post in mid-May a very strong op-ed in support of Powell, and even going further than Powell, in the sense of not only do we have to negotiate with the Palestinians to end this, but we have to be willing to participate in an international force to separate the parties.
Sure, yeah.
It's way out
right.
there. And I think that's highly significant because this isn't just about Powell.
Mm-hmm.
This, I believe, is about the George W. administration in foreign policy really repudiating the basic thrust of his father's foreign policy, which was essentially fairly realist. But these guys are in a completely different class.
And that embodied in Colin Powell, who, of course, was the National Security Advisor and then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under the first President Bush. We're also joined by Mary Louise Kelly. She's the diplomatic correspondent for National Public Radio. Welcome.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Well, nice to have you. What about the secretary himself? Are there any signs of his frustration with the Bush administration in his offhand comments, in his body language? What are you hearing?
There are some small signs. It's always hard to tell with Secretary Powell because he is so calm, so self-possessed. He does not give away a lot of what he's thinking. That said, when this latest round of reports started circulating in the past couple of weeks, at the end of last month, rumors really reaching critical mass that he might be thinking of leaving the Bush administration, he was asked about this in front of a gaggle of State Department reporters, and he was briefly but very visibly annoyed. It was a very firm no in response to the question, are you thinking of resigning? He's then softened and said, look, I see these reports every 2 weeks. You guys write about it every couple of weeks. And he sort of laughed and said they always make great reading. But it was clear that he was annoyed about being asked about it yet again. Secretary Powell has admitted himself in the past few weeks, he's sort of admitted, look, there are battles from time to time within this administration. That's true of any administration. He says when you have people with strongly held views, that's going to happen. But it is actually very hard to tell what exactly he's thinking. And you know, that's been something widely remarked on in Washington.
What about within the State Department? What are people saying there? Is morale hurt by these reverses of their chief? Or what's the scuttlebutt?
He's incredibly popular at the State Department. I mean, there's phenomenal loyalty there. It's very, very difficult to find someone on the record, off the record, who has anything negative to say about him. You really don't hear a lot of criticism coming from inside the State Department. That said, there are certainly those in Washington who would like to see his view and the view of moderates at the State Department prevail more often. I mean, you were quoting the New York Times editorial recently saying, look, he's shown us he can loyally follow the president. Can he guide U.S. policy and really advance U.S. interests overseas? And that's the question that a lot of people are still waiting to see answered. He's very loyal in following the president. Will he be as loyal in the long run following his own deep personal convictions? And that's what a lot of Powell watchers are waiting to see.
What are those personal convictions? What do you sense? What do you sense they are about the world now?
I think Jim got at that a little bit. He certainly is viewed, I think, both in the U.S. and abroad as multilateralist, as more moderate. When I was doing my own reporting on this topic of Colin Powell, will he stay, will he go? In the past few weeks, I talked to a number of people overseas in Europe, in the Middle East, and they all pretty much across the board say we see him as the moderate voice of the Bush administration. He is the friendly voice to which we turn. The concern, and I think this is a growing concern outside the United States, is that if he is seen as being overruled time after time after time after time, then whether he stays, whether he goes, he becomes a little bit less relevant. His influence is a little bit diminished with each time. It's almost that sort of death by a thousand cuts scenario that ultimately, if he is seen to be sidelined or overruled time after time after time on policy after policy after policy, that people start listening to him a little bit less.
If I could...
Go ahead, sure.
I mean, I don't know what Colin Powell himself thinks, and I don't pretend to, or the people, most of the people around him. I don't have that kind of access. But to me, it's less important whether he decide to stay or go. To me, it's the most important issue at this point is what will get the attention of the American people. I think, as was just said, most of people abroad, particularly in Europe, now, I think, understand much better what the basic kind of worldview of the dominant sectors in this administration are, and they are frightened by it, and I think they should be. What is not so clear is that people in the United States understand kind of the thrust or the trajectory of this policy and what kinds of commitments are being made that I personally believe fly very much in the face of Powell's worldview. Certainly of Scowcroft's worldview and of the Bush father's worldview, let alone anyone to the left of that.
Richard Holbrooke was recently quoted as saying, since the administration can no longer maintain that these aren't major internal disagreements, they've decided they might as well try to contain them by saying that all administrations have disagreements. The dilemma here is that these just aren't personal disagreements bred out of ambition. These are deep philosophical differences between two very different views of America in the world. One is a traditional conservative view. The other is a radical break with 55 years of bipartisan tradition that sought international agreements and regimes of benefit to us. That's Richard Holbrooke, the former U.N. ambassador under President Carter. Do people at the State Department see it in those terms, a fundamental clash of worldviews, Mary Louise Kelly?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I think certainly, as you say, Holbrooke has said it, and Powell himself has said it, there are clashing views within this administration. I think many people at the State Department would argue that that is a good thing. The Bush administration places such a premium on loyalty, on speaking with one voice. Isn't a little bit of debate a good thing? And the question is whether one side is always losing that debate. And again, people at the State Department who I have interviewed say, no, that's in fact not the case. There have been some very public humiliations and reversals of policy. The UN family planning decision, which we were talking about a few moments ago, is one of them. Certainly there have been some humiliating defeats on the Middle East. There have also been some areas where Colin Powell has prevailed on the Middle East. This possibility of Yasser Arafat staying on in a figurehead role, this is something that the White House has not come out against. That appears to be something that a lot of people are considering as a real possibility for a way to bypass the current situation. And it's even something that Yasser Arafat has come out through a spokesman and said, yeah, maybe we could sign on to this. So this is seen as a potential triumph.
He's won some as well as lost many. We're talking about the future of Colin Powell this hour at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about Colin Powell. Should he resign? Will he? The sum of his humiliations has grown in recent weeks. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now by Mary Bell Batcher. She's a former longtime Powell aide, and currently she's the chief of staff for Nevada Governor Kenny Gwynn. Hello, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
Well, just fine, thanks. You know Colin Powell, and obviously you like him and respect him a great deal. This is a proud man. And is there a point with this man where his pride comes into conflict with his loyalty, and that he has to, first of all, stand up for himself? What do you think about that?
Well, I've got to assume that you're or it sounds like you're making some assumptions that perhaps I wouldn't agree with, and
okay.
That is that there's some turmoil that would lead him to do what you're suggesting. I think that what's missing from this discussion is that the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor to the President, and in fact all who serve on the national security or serve within the national security advisors to the president, there is always good and healthy debate. There's always good and healthy discussion that usually arrives at a policy that is pronounced by the president.
Sure.
And that is always, that is traditionally. I mean, you can go back to the post-world era and always you find that. And I think the best policy of the United States is usually arrived at through that process.
I guess the question is, has Powell been losing more than he's been winning?
I don't think I view it that way.
Okay.
I think that Secretary Powell has been giving, as has his Deputy Secretary Rich Armitage, have been giving very good and thorough advice to the President, the Vice President, and Condi Rice. And through that advice, the president arrives at a policy he needs to arrive at.
Right.
I don't think this is an issue of winning and losing. Secretary Powell doesn't think that way.
Yeah. Well, give us an insight then into his character. We hear about his loyalty above all, but what about, again, I'm trying to get at this, is there a conflict between his loyalty and his convictions? Or tell us at least about his character. Describe it for us.
Well, I mean, you've really hit on a very important part that is just central to his character, and that is loyalty and integrity. And he's very pragmatic. He is not a person who is set by some ideology or driven by that. He is a man who studies issues thoroughly. He is a man who seeks out a great deal of information from all factors and all sides, and he's very decisive. He lands on the decision after that kind of thorough process of review, and then he gives his president the advice that he thinks is best for the issue at hand.
Mm-hmm.
Pragmatic, and very full of integrity and very loyal.
Mm. He among his rules that he includes in his autobiography is this one: avoid having your ego so close to your position that when your position fails, your ego goes with it.
That's true. That's very true, and that is his pragmatic side. He is a man who is very comfortable within himself, and I think he's a person who understands that you have to be comfortable with yourself and not so attached to your title that drives you.
Right, right. What about the point that I quoted Richard Holbrooke earlier, that Powell and the administration really and the rest of them, Cheney, Rumsfeld, et cetera, really have a clash of fundamental worldviews here. Powell is the traditional U.S. conservative foreign policy that we've seen since World War II, multilateral and so on, and the others represent something new and a sort of radical departure, and so that there really is something fundamental at stake here. Is that your sense of this?
I would probably describe it a bit different than Ambassador Holbrooke, but and probably not quite so polarized as that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are good and sound differences. However, I think that through the interagency process that has served this president and prior presidents very, very well, differences, if they exist, are sorted through.
Mm-hmm.
Good, healthy debate is a best way to arrive at policy, truly.
Mm-hmm. And certainly in his career, Colin Powell has seen a lot of that, hasn't he? He saw in the Reagan administration the conflicts between Secretary Weinberger at Defense and Secretary Shultz State.
Well, I think that as I said, traditionally, if you go back to through the 50s, if you go back to John Foster Dulles era, on through the 60s and 70s and right up, as you just remarked, even the Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, and Secretary Shultz, though they had worked together previously at Bechtel Power Corporation, one for the other, yes, of course, when they got into a national security framework, there are different differences of opinion, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the administration is polarized and incapable of arriving at decent policy. I think, in fact, it's very healthy.
Mm. Well, Mary Bell Batcher, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Mary Bell Batcher, she's a former longtime Powell aide, and currently she's chief of staff for Nevada Governor Kenny Gwynn. We're talking about Colin Powell and his future in this administration this hour at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Siddiqui is on the line. Hello. Welcome.
Yes, good evening. I was calling essentially perspective of, you know, being a black man is that Powell should have resigned a long time ago.
Why?
Well, I mean, they talk about the quote-unquote string of defeats in the administration that he suffered.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just don't believe, and I think that a lot of people don't believe, that this is not a battle of the wills or the minds, if you will. I mean, essentially, this is an individual who has been put in the position of Secretary of State and has nothing. He's been totally disrespected the entire he's been. I remember when the last year when they had the international conference on racism in Durban, South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States didn't want to participate because they knew they could have been an embarrassment in terms of their history, in terms of their racial problem here. And who was the mouthpiece saying that their delegation was leaving?
Mm-hmm.
Him along with Condoleezza, who has an equal amount of power. So the bottom line here is that when he gets in that room with Rumsfeld and Cheney and Bush, I mean, he's not on equal ground with them. You know, he's being treated like a boy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, after he came back from his first trip to the Mideast, while he was over there trying to come up with a peace plan, and Rumsfeld and Bush are cozying up to Sharon and saying, go to it, which is a complete contradiction in regards to what he was saying, he was totally embarrassed when he got back. Did he stay on? He should have resigned immediately.
Well, why do you think he stays on?
I don't call this loyalty. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't understand it because of the fact in terms of someone of you know, his history and background in terms of his service here, that for him to give up what I consider to be his integrity and manhood to be in this position, that I don't understand why he remains, because it's one thing to hang in there thinking that you're going to make a difference, but he's not, because they're undermining everything that he puts forth. Everything.
Well, that's a strong statement. Jim Loeb, does that resonate with you?
Well, I mean, I have great respect for Powell, and I followed him, you know, fairly closely, and I imagine that he's really torn by the situation himself,
sure.
And that is as to what is the highest loyalty. And I think one of his great concerns is that if he did leave, the person who would take his place would not be of his choosing. somebody who would simply confirm the general trajectory of the administration that is, as Holbrooke described, really a radical break with traditional U.S. foreign policy, at least since World War II. And I think that bothers him tremendously.
And you even mentioned that he especially fears that Paul Wolfowitz,
well,
the deputy.
Well, I was told by somebody that.
Yeah, he's the deputy.
He said it in a kind of joke, as in, like, you know,
right,
oh,
okay.
Well, wouldn't that be a nightmare?
Yeah. He's the deputy secretary of defense.
I mean, one thing that's worth, to me, it's really what's at stake is policy rather than personality.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Richard Armitage is the number two guy under Powell.
Yep.
And in terms of political philosophy, I think he's kind of between Powell and, say, the people around Cheney or the people around Rumsfeld.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, he, in very scarcely veiled references in big publications like The Times and The Post, you know, refers to a lot of the people who are making Powell's life miserable from a philosophical point of view, that is, the people who represent this break. He refers to them as pissants. And whenever you see that quotation in any paper as to some high administration source, that's Armitage. And I think that is a measure of the anger that's felt on a personal as well as a policy level
mm-hmm.
around people who are very close to Powell, because Armitage is very close to Powell.
Yeah. John is calling from Trevor, Wisconsin. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Welcome.
Welcome, thank you. Yes, I just wanted to say that Mr. Powell, one of the biggest problems that he's realized, and he's had it with the administration, is that he realizes that if you have a large fire,
mm-hmm.
a big fire, and the fire is very hot,
mm-hmm.
and it's putting out a lot of sparks and a lot of embers, and they're starting small fires, he realizes that you don't go around chasing and, you know, trying to put out all the small fires. You deal with the large fire,
mm-hmm.
and that would be the Middle East conflict that you have over there with the Palestinians and Israelis.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that he realizes his biggest problem is that he doesn't actually agree with the administration.
Mm-hmm.
But he also realizes that by leaving, he could be doing more
right.
harm by leaving than actually by staying. So actually, I believe that he's a brave man, sacrificing his dignity, his other stuff by dealing with situations like that.
Mm. Well, that's an interesting read, Mary Louise Kelly. That this is a man of fortitude who's sucking up his personal humiliations for the good of the country.
That seems reasonable that there may well be some truth to that. I think he is a man of strong convictions, and he probably sees that he can do quite a lot from within the administration and has achieved some very real policy triumphs, and there is probably some truth to that. The other sort of interesting point that we haven't gotten at
mm-hmm.
yet is the fact that everyone really likes Colin Powell, both
mm-hmm.
within and outside the administration. His popularity ratings are through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
The most recent Harris poll that's been out showed his favorability rating at 76% to the president's 62%. So 76 to 62, that makes him far and away the most popular member of the Bush administration. He has a tremendous amount of leverage, in terms of sort of if he wants to go out there and make his voice heard and have his view prevail more often.
Yes, he is a national figure in the way that George Shultz or President Clinton's secretaries of state.
Warren Christopher, exactly. Yes, quite right.
This is a man of world fame, a author of a best-selling book, universally admired, except really by the right in America. That, I think, is clear. They don't like him, and Bush actually probably had to do some persuading to get him there. We're joined now on the line by Lawrence Kaplan. He's a senior editor at The New Republic. Welcome. Thanks for joining us, Lawrence.
Thanks for having me, Jack.
I want to read to you something Colin Powell wrote about Iraq in his memoir, Colin Powell, An American Journey, and ask you what you think of it and whether he still believes it and whether this might be an issue where he would really want to part from the administration in a public way. Here's what he wrote. It would not contribute to the stability we want in the Middle East to have Iraq fragmented into separate Sunni, Shia, and Kurd political entities. The only way to have avoided this outcome was to have undertaken a largely U.S. conquest and occupation of a remote nation of 20 million people. I don't think that is what the American people signed up for. Is that what's your reaction to that?
Well, I have several reactions. The first is that as a soldier in uniform, Powell should not have had a say in the matter. Unfortunately, he did.
We're talking about the Persian Gulf War.
Exactly, yeah. When he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Second of all, because of that decision, and he used that argument to successfully persuade the first President Bush to halt fighting after 100 hours, thousands of Kurds in northern Iraq and Shiites in southern Iraq, whom we had encouraged to rebel against Saddam, were slaughtered. Powell convinced the president not to aid these people who he had encouraged to rise up, and he convinced Bush not to shoot down Iraqi helicopters. And actually, the seeds of the present fight that you've been discussing on this show were sown 10 years ago during the Gulf War, when many of the principals in today's debate fought over this issue, and the fight got very emotional and very tense because people like Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, who is then Undersecretary of Defense, felt passionately about aiding the Kurds and the Shiites, and Powell trotted out a sort of almost a Kissingerian argument, said, well, you know, Iraq could split up and that would lead to instability. And in the name of that argument, we essentially, I think, engaged in a terrible moral abdication and essentially allowed our proxies to be slaughtered. And I think he's people under him at the State Department are rehashing the argument today. But I don't see how Iraq could be much worse off than it is under Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein's about as bad as they get. And it's not clear to me if there is anybody worse that could possibly replace him.
Mm-hmm. But what about his thought, and this is written in 1996, I think, when he wrote this book, that the American people have not signed up for the conquest and occupation, long-time occupation of a nation of 20 million people far away. That remains true, isn't it?
I don't know. Well, I think generally the president and Congress declare war. Wars are not put to a national referendum. The American people have their say in the sense that they vote for the representatives and congressmen and president who make these decisions. But constitutionally, for better or worse, the decision to go to war does not lie directly with the average American citizen. They give these powers to their elected officials, and exactly what the American people have or have not signed up for remains a subject of ample disagreement. But actually, the polls I've seen lately, at least, are overwhelmingly in support of a war against Iraq.
Hmm. And yet I've seen a piece in the Times the other day in Scottsdale, Arizona, interviewing many people, many of them Republicans, saying we like the president, we like what he's doing on the war on terror, but Iraq, this is a country too far. A lot of reservation out there, it seems.
Of course, and justifiably so.
Colin Powell would be the voice of that, presumably.
Well, he would be the voice of that, but you could make the argument that his opponents within the administration, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Cheney, would be the voice of just as many, particularly in the Republican base.
Sure. Lawrence Kaplan, thank you very much. Lawrence Kaplan is a senior editor at the New Republic. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about Colin Powell's future. Should he soldier on in the Bush administration in the face of policy reversals? Or should he make a resignation on principle? And what would that principle be? Richard Holbrooke, the diplomat, says that Powell and the rest of the administration are in a deep philosophical disagreement about two very different views of America in the world. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Frank is on the line. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Hi, Jack. Your question was, why does Colin Powell stay on?
Yeah.
And I believe that Colin Powell stays on for Colin Powell. He is the quintessential go-along, get-along guy. I served in the Nixon administration under Don Rumsfeld as director of OEO and Dick Cheney as his special assistant at the time, and Colin Powell was a White House fellow. You never heard him say anything, ever, about the issues that were confronting black folks, if you will, in America. In his book, he talks about how he just drove away from the hamburger stand because he didn't want to raise an issue, I guess, when he was denied service. This man is more concerned about himself and his own future. He has been involved with the Republican Party for years and years and years. He has no intention of disrupting those relationships, and he will stay there and do what he's asked to do. He will soldier on, no question about it. But the question of what Colin Powell believes is answered simply. Colin Powell believes in himself. He believes in his own future, and the question of principles hardly are raised. He's a wonderful interlocutor. He can speak and convince you that he is completely earnest in his views of moderation or even, God save us, liberalism or progressivity. But he's allowed to do that up to a point. He can speak. He's being used. He has been paid well over the years. But he will continue to do what he's required to do. He will never resign.
You're painting a picture of a careerist, a fundamentally sort of compromised man who long ago sort of mailed in his manhood and said, okay, whatever you want, I'll do it.
I think that's exactly right. If you look at his rise in the military, it's because of the decisions he made and because of the relationships he made. He did this dance about whether he was going to become a Democrat or Republican. He knew exactly what he was going to become, what he had always been from the outset. Mm. And he also knows where the margins are. Mm. He was being touted by white America, essentially, for at least some parts of white America, for the presidency of the United States. He knew full well that he would never be supported by the likes of Rumsfeld and Cheney and indeed Bush for a position like that.
Yeah.
And yet he continues to, he will soldier on, and he will continue to mislead us in the sense that he will say the right things. He's a wonderful interlocutor, as I said, and that's why he's valuable to them.
But no sand.
No sand. He's not going to. Okay. He doesn't have the grit.
Yeah.
I was one of the first people that left the Nixon administration on principle. I was the deputy director of the Office of Legal Services, and Don Rumsfeld was in the midst. He and Dick Cheney were in the midst of the act. They were the action guys on the Southern Strategy.
Yep. Yep.
And I resisted it, mm-hmm. and I refused to resign because I wanted to force them to fire me. This man has no grit.
All right,
that kind of thing.
Frank, thank you very much. Jim Loeb, how does that strike you? No grit. This is a decorated war hero, after all.
I'm not a judge of those things. And as I say, I think the policy is more important than
right,
the personality.
Right.
But I think probably Mary Louise might have more
insight. Okay, Mary Louise.
Well, you know, our guest talked about him, Colin Powell, being a good soldier. And that's certainly something that comes out over and over and over when you interview people about Colin Powell who do know him far better than I and who work closely with him. I could have, you know, if I'd had a dollar for every person I talked to who said Colin Powell is a good soldier and he will stick it out, I would be on my way to becoming a rich woman. You know, I don't know. I suppose I would take some issue with the idea that this is all part of a masterful career plot that would assume that when he left as chairman of the Joint Chiefs, that he was plotting a move back into
right.
Some future Republican
right.
administration,
right.
and this would certainly not have been the most direct route if that was his goal all along.
It certainly wouldn't be. And, of course, this stuff has dogged him in his autobiography. He has to deal with the question that Bob Woodward raised in his book called The Commanders, about the generals of the Gulf War. And there, Woodward alleges that he just did not speak up and give his real convictions at White House meetings about Iraq, and that he wanted to extend the sanctions. He did not want to do Desert Storm, and that he really soft-pedaled his own dissent out of, as Frank says, the desire to get along and go along. Well, you know, we're joined now by Lawrence Levine. He's a professor of history at George Mason University and is the author of Defender of the Faith, William Jennings Bryan, The Last Decade, 1915-1925. And you may be asking yourself, what on earth does William Jennings Bryan have to do with this? Well, in fact, he does have something to do with it. William Jennings Bryan, along with one other Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance, were the only two Secretaries of State to resign on principle in the 20th century. And there's a kind of similitude between William Jennings Bryan and Mr. Powell. Lawrence Levine, tell us why, what were the circumstances of William Jennings Bryan's resignation from the Wilson administration in 1915?
Well, the circumstances were the sinking of the Lusitania, a British ship in which over 1,100 lives were lost. Over about 128 of them were Americans. The Germans had warned Americans not to sail in the zone around England on belligerent ships. At the cost of their own lives, Americans continued to do that, and the Germans began to sink ships on which Americans were. Wilson wrote a very strong note to Germany. Bryan begged him not to. Bryan's argument was that the Allies, Britain and France, were violating American shipping rights just as Germany was, and that we should handle Germany even-handedly, and he was afraid that this note would lead to war, but he signed it. When Germany rejected the note and said that they were going to continue to sink ships with their submarines, Wilson wrote a stronger note, the second Lusitania note, which Bryan refused to sign, and in lieu of that, he resigned from his office. Let me say that Bryan's profile is the diametric opposite of the profile that's just been drawn by some of your guests and by your last caller. He was a politician. He had a national following. He ran for the presidency three times, 1896, 1900, and 1908 on the Democratic Party. He was partly responsible for Wilson getting the nomination in 1912, which is why he was appointed Secretary of State. So he's a man whose entire life had been composed of taking strong stands, of differing with other politicians. His relationship to the Democratic Party was something like Secretary Powell's relationship to the military, except Bryan was willing to break with the Democratic Party when he had to. Though he didn't really break with it. He broke with the Democratic president and not only resigned, but then led a campaign against our entry into the war.
And so when he resigned, would he make a speech about why he resigned?
Well, he did. These are words that one doesn't hear from Secretary Powell. When God tells a man to speak, he cannot stop to count those who stand with him. He must speak even though he cries in the wilderness. He must stand up even if he has to stand alone. And the day he resigned, he announced to his friends, "I go out into the darkness." He understood, and he became one of the least popular people in America, at least in terms of the press. He was attacked as a traitor, as a Benedict Arnold, as an antichrist.
Mm. And he was really a sort of Christian pacifist, wasn't he?
He was probably not a pacifist, but he did believe that he was certainly a Christian and he was a fundamentalist, and he believed that God had created America to lead the way and to show a decadent Europe that there was a path to peace, there was a path to democratic living, there was a path to a higher way, and for us to join the war would be like for a sober man to lie down in the gutter with a drunkard instead of showing him the way to step out of the gutter. In other words, Bryan really felt that we had a sacred mission in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a man who spoke in 19th century terms, I think, 19th century Protestant terms.
Mm-hmm. And his resignation didn't really prevent us from getting from the drift to war, did it?
No, his resignation and his long campaign. This was 1915. We weren't to enter the war for almost 2 years. And he fought completely against Wilson's policies. But no, they did not. Ultimately, submarine warfare help Wilson bring us into the war. The difference is that Wilson and his administration saw England as the hope. They couldn't let England go down.
Sure.
Bryan never understood that. America was the hope, and America had to stand high.
Yeah. Lawrence Levine, thank you so much for giving us that historical allusion.
You are very welcome.
We have on the line Laurel Lynn. Hello.
Hi, Jack. It's Laurel Lynn. I want to regress back to your earlier focus of the question, should he leave or should he stay? Has he been humiliated enough to leave? And I think on the one hand, I would say, yes, absolutely, he should. We've never heard anybody raise the issue of taking the visa function, for example, out of the State Department ever until Colin Powell was Secretary of State. Ariel Sharon, for a very, very long time, simply didn't bother to return his phone calls. So I think that there's something to be said for having been humiliated enough such that he really should leave. But the fact of the matter is, I think that Colin has some plans of his own within this madness, like dealing with Sudan, dealing with the emerging markets countries, like working within Africa foreign policy and so on and so forth. And I think the major issue is that in the first Bush administration, he was basically a performer. He was my dear boy, my poor child, sent over there to prosecute an illegitimate and awful war against the Iraqi people. You couldn't have found a better performer, and he did reasonably well.
Yes.
Now, under the new administration, he has the parameters within the State Department to be a thinker. Who in such a position could stand up against a Condi Rice, a Rumsfeld, a Cheney, and a Wolfowitz? Who could do that?
Well, you've certainly given us the sides in stark terms. Thank you for that. Let's get in another call. Paul is on the line.
Hi, Jack. How are you?
Welcome.
I think one thing that's going on, perhaps elaborating on your previous caller, and my assumption may or may not have to do with how solipsistic Paul is or how much of a man of conviction he is, but I think basically the one of the things that hasn't been considered is that Colin Powell is being used in the following manner, that the Western Europe and the Middle East modern Middle East countries simply don't respect President Bush. They don't respect his basic skills as a leader, his intellect, his simplistic ways of looking at global conflict, and his lack of diplomatic skills and demeanor. And I think Bush obviously knows this. He's using Powell as a way to go through the motions of placating the Europeans and the Middle East countries. And even though both the president and those countries know it, that they're going through the motions anyway, and basically this is a way of Bush telling those countries to go to the dumper, and Powell's caught in the middle.
Mary Louise Kelly, is that Powell caught in the middle between the European and other allies and the Bush administration?
Well, there's probably some truth to that. I mean, you can call Colin Powell many things. A foreign policy lightweight is not one of them. His credentials were incredibly important to the Bush campaign and to the Bush administration coming in, and I think he remains very, very important. I mean, to pick up on some of those issues that the callers have raised, the visa issue, for example, and the current debate over whether that should be taken away from the State Department and handed over to a new, yet-to-be-formed Department of Homeland Security. I think many people would argue that that has more to do with September 11th and the reaction to that than to any management or mismanagement that would be directly traced back to Colin Powell.
Jim Loeb, last thought on Colin Powell?
Well, my last thought is I think he does have grit, and I wanted to comment on that, because what Mr. Kaplan said from the New Republic, to be faced with those attacks constantly over the last year and a half in the press by people like Mr. Kaplan and Mr. Kristol and others, I think just to hang on takes a certain amount of grit. But I, as a last thought, I think he should leave. And I think he should leave for the good of the country, because I think the country should understand what the Europeans now have been slow to understand, but now I think clearly understand, which is we are on a very dangerous path with this administration.
Jim Loeb, thank you. Jim Loeb is Washington Bureau Chief at the Interpress Service. And Mary Louise Kelly, thank you. She's the diplomatic correspondent for National Public Radio. Continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is WBU.